Welcome, everyone. Welcome to Hometown Alaska. My name is Charles Wolforth, and we're here for a topic which you may not find on shock radio, but you will find here on KSKA, and that is civil discourse, or how do we get along? How do we work things out? How do we talk to each other in a respectful way? How do we solve our problems and sort of see each other respectfully, not just as opponents? It's kind of a big problem. It's something that a lot of people feel is a problem in our society right now that we need to deal with. And so I've got a couple of guests here that we're going to talk about that with. I hate to do labeling. Labeling is the worst thing, but I did reach out to get somebody I consider to be a liberal and a conservative, but also people who have a lot of good thoughts on this and who can contribute to a really positive conversation. And I'll get into full introductions in just a minute, but I have Libby Roderick, who is a well-known musician, grew up in Anchorage, and is with the UAA APU Difficult Dialogues Project. Welcome, Libby.
Thank you.
And Becky Hultberg, who is probably pretty well-known to people who read the newspaper, watch TV. She was Governor Murkowski's press secretary. She's now with Providence Health System, I believe it's called.
Thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure. And neither both are here to talk about their own opinions, not necessarily representing the organizations where they're working. I had the most. And I'm Charles Wolforth. I'm a writer. I'm a former politician. I went straight, and also a journalist. And I was on a panel at the Alaska Press Club conference on Friday on the same subject of civil discourse, civility. And it was your typical panel for about the first 45 minutes. And then people started to get mad. And it kind of degenerated as people were taking positions, repeating their positions over again without really taking what the other person had to say into account, getting their feelings hurt, getting angry. And before it was over, this civility panel had turned into pandemonium, essentially. And everybody was talking at once, and it was chaos. It was such a good demonstration of the problem we're talking about in terms of just getting mad and not being able to have a discussion that led anywhere. One of the folks who was there wrote a column about it for the Daily News, which is on their website, and we've put a link to that on our website, ADN. The Uncivil War, and in my opinion, he got something wrong. I sent in a comment that turned into a battle between the commenters, some attacking, some defending, again, a lot of name calling, very little illumination shed. I think probably everybody out there has a few stories like this, and Libby Roderick, maybe you have some thoughts about, I mean, what is the problem we're talking about, and any examples of things you've seen that you thought, this isn't working?
Well, there's so many of them these days. I think we all know that. I mean, again, like we were talking about earlier, there's everything from road rage, where you make a simple mistake on the road and somebody flips you off or yells at you and you're kind of stunned by that. Or, you know, I'm involved in this Ford Foundation Difficult Dialogues Project for two Alaskan universities. And the reason that they sent out the request for proposals to universities nationwide is that there is so much incivility on our campuses. Professors aren't willing to take on certain topics because people will stand up in class and belittle them or yell things or stomp out of the room or threaten people. Or there's been incidences on campus where people drive into the quad in a car and aim at people. You know, I mean, It's wild on that regard. Personally, I'll tell you the thing that gets me the most. I don't watch television very often, and part of it is because when you watch any of those supposedly discussion or public policy things, they're actually yelling at each other and interrupting, and I can't hear what they're trying to say. So
right.
I think we've all got a lot of examples.
Yeah, Becky, Becky Hope, as the press secretary, you must have run into some pretty difficult situations.
I dealt with some very civil, very engaging folks, and some that were quite frankly difficult to be around. I really believe from a sort of a political and public policy perspective that public policy affects people's lives. It makes them better. It makes them worse. And I've been increasingly disturbed as we're in an environment now where we can't even talk about it. We can't even sit down at the table sometimes and have real conversations about those issues that are going to in turn affect people's lives. And you just look at some of the political dynamics going on in this country, and to a certain extent, lesser extent, and maybe, you know, to a heightened extent in previous years in our state, where if you look at the Tea Party phenomenon, you have some extremely uncivil behavior in that group. You have some very civil behavior in that group. And then in opponents of the Tea Party phenomenon, you have some very uncivil behavior. You have people who just want to throw rocks and call names, and people who are approaching it in a little more pragmatic way. So that's one example nationally. I think a couple of years ago, we had similar incivility in our own state. Seems to have calmed down a little bit more now, but you looked at the Sarah Palin phenomenon, and boy, that really got people very riled up on one side or the other. But the bottom line is, if we're going to actually make decisions that affect people's lives in a good way, we have to be able to sit down and talk.
Right, right. And it's a good point that it runs across the gamut, and there are very few people who are innocent, and it's really easy to get caught up in and to realize, boy, I didn't say that in the best way. Yeah. Well, I would like to get you listeners involved here. It's a topic that certainly affects every single person. And as long as you can engage civilly, we invite you to be on the air. And even if you're not so civil, we'll put up with a little bit of that. The phone number here is 550-8433, 550-8433. The long-distance number, toll-free, is 1-888-353-5752. And the email is hometownalaska@ksKA.org. And I get those right here in the studio, and I'll read them on the air. And I would just note that we're live in the 2 o'clock hour, so if you're listening at 10, you're listening to a recording and you shouldn't call in. There's so many culprits one can point to as the bad guys in this. And one that has struck me is the change in media. In other words, the online media and cable TV and so many more voices. You know, if you think back to when we were kids and there were just a few networks and it's just sort of a serious old guy talking, now you've got people shouting and people trying to get your attention all the time. And Becky, as somebody who's worked in media, I wonder if you feel like maybe that's something that has caused part of the problem, is just simply the sales aspect of getting out there and grabbing people's attention.
Well, I think we could spend a whole hour on that topic alone. I think there's a couple things, though, that are worth noting. And the first is we used to have traditional media, and that was about, everyone knew who the media was and what their role was. We've really had a blurring of the lines between entertainment and media. And so it's very easy when you're talking about New York Times to say, that's media. And when you're talking about, a certain blog to say, well, that's entertainment, or a Huffington Post kind of, But even some of those distinctions now are not so easy to make, especially when you look in the middle. And are you trying to sell your product, or are you trying to inform? And especially when it comes to some of the cable news networks, some of the online media outlets, it's very difficult to distinguish. And if the goal is to sell, then it becomes as much about entertainment as news. And when it's entertainment, controversy is the most important thing. And so if there is none, what do you do? Well, you attempt to stage it and create it. And so we're kind of in an environment where it's really difficult to discern what is news and what is entertainment. I think that's one of the major issues.
Yeah. Well, Libby, you working with people sort of in the campus level and in the local level, do you think those messages are coming down from the media and affecting people's behavior, or are there other things that are affecting their behavior in terms of becoming more confrontational and having trouble having good dialogues?
I think it's many different things. Certainly the media does affect it. I mean, people are besieged with media, and we're a technology crazed, society. And I think the fractionating of it, where each person can just listen to whoever they want to, whoever they agree with, listen to music that they like and not listen to any other music they don't want to, listen to the commentators that they agree with, and is part of the problem. And I personally don't know as much, certainly, as you do, Becky, about the news and the history of the media and so forth, but Fox News, when something is blurred between editorializing, you may call it entertainment, I would call it editorializing, and news, and so many people watch it, and there isn't some strict rule and criteria where we say you cannot call it news. if it doesn't meet certain criteria and if you're interjecting certain kind of ideologies into it. And shock radio, as you know, all the things that you've said, I do think it really affects people, particularly young people.
That's modeling for them.
Yeah, they're very – yes, it's modeling. I think politicians affect them. I think that one of the things that we've determined in terms of campaigning, for starters, our politicians are doing year-long campaigning at this point. There is no break in the campaigning for many politicians. And that I think the research does show that people do, in fact, respond to negative campaigning. And they do respond to extreme comments in the election years that may or may not play out later in the politics, but that we're seeing these very extreme views succeed with the body politic. But my first thought had to do with, I think, something you've even commented on before, Charles, which has to do with our educational system, which is that we're not currently doing the best job we could be at training young people at critical thinking, at how to take apart an argument and determine whether it's specious or it's based in something, at determining is this statement that has been made in the media or wherever by a politician based in fact, or simply their opinion, or even just a speculation, or just slurs on people. We've seen in elections where on both sides people mm-hmm. make claims about somebody else that are not true, and yet they fly into the media as a claim that was made. Somebody said this about somebody else, and so suddenly the population is talking about whether Obama was born here. You know, that kind of thing works. And young people aren't taught to, you know, here's the internet. Where did the source of this information come from? Mm-hmm. You know, we're just not teaching the public, like I mentioned to you guys, you know, the three-legged stool. You've got to have a discerning public. You've got mm-hmm. to have a responsible, you know, media. And you've got to have politicians that are operating on principle. And we've got shaky legs on all three.
Let me just come back to you in just a second, Becky. We have a caller that I didn't want to keep on hold too long. Leslie, did you have a comment?
Hi, Libby.
Hi.
Well, as usual, I agree with everything that Libby said, and she actually gave me a perfect segue to my comment, which is, you know, I consider myself, I guess, a moderate liberal, but I've tried really hard because of where we live to spend some time listening to and watching the media, however you classify it, sort of on both sides of the spectrum. And it's, you know, I have no data to support this, but it's been my perception that while there's certainly vitriol on both sides, I get the sense, and I'm really curious to hear your thoughts on this from both of the guests, that a lot of the disinformation and misinformation, things like Obama not being born in the U.S. and some of those other things, tends to come more from the right than from the left. And I think that makes it very difficult to have it's hard to have a civil discourse about Obama's policies when you can't get past but he's secretly a Muslim who's not an American citizen.
All right.
And
well,
I'll take my response off the air.
Well, thanks for calling. I'm actually not so sure about that, but I'd like to hear your opinion.
Yeah,
Becky.
Well, I think coming from the other side of the spectrum, we have a president who's a Democrat right now, and we have a Congress that's clearly Democratic. So I think it's easy. I guess I disagree with that. I think right now it's, of course, our politicians are Democrats, and you're going to be having arrows from the right thrown at them. With a Republican president and a Republican Congress, I think you'd see the same activity on the left. And as a matter of fact, if you look back at when George Bush was president, mm-hmm. he had some pretty awful bombs lobbed at him as well. Regardless of how you think of his job performance, there were things said about him, I think, that were equally inflammatory. So I really don't think this is an issue where we can – it's very simplistic, and that was the comment I wanted to make before. It's very simplistic to say this is a problem of this group or this group, and if we just fix them or did this, it would go away. I think we live in an incredibly complex world. And I like to say that we've really lost the art of complexity and nuance in our society. We, because of the complexity of our world, I think we want to reduce things because we can't, because of the noise and the complexity, it's more comfortable if we reduce them. So we intentionally take very complex issues and our politicians, our media, and we reduce them to their element. The problem with that is when we don't acknowledge the complexity we live with and that these aren't soundbite solutions mm-hmm. or soundbite issues, that they require real thought and none of us have the perfect answer.
Yeah, I think that part of that oversimplicity you're talking about is this issue of the two sides, you know, one side against the other, and kind of assuming that your side's right and that the other side's wrong. And as I sort of think back, George Bush, oh yeah, that Michael Moore movie where they kind of said that he went to war in Iraq because of something about Saudi Arabia, and it didn't seem very well substantiated. And that was really, that was really pretty extreme, you know. And I definitely didn't support the war in Iraq, but I also, hopefully had enough critical thinking skills to see, boy, he really didn't make his case with that. So, you know, how do we draw back from that? How do we get to where we're not just seeing the other side as the enemy, looking at their faults, not looking at the faults of the side that we agree with? Libby, do you have a comment on that?
I think, you know, there are some macro actions we can take and some micro actions we can take. In terms of the, you know, educational system, I really think that we all need to take responsibility for pressing for more emphasis on process, on critical thinking, on teaching our young people how to engage with difference. This is a pluralistic society. It's one of its best qualities. No other nation tries to accommodate.
We'd like to have a solution before the kids grow up, though. I mean, what do we do with those of us who are already, already here?
But I think, you know, one very important thing is to make sure that our young people start seeing better models.
I agree.
You know,
yeah.
And we will have to be those models in order for them to see those models. I think in terms of the media, you know, we need to be boycotting shows and that sensationalize and, you know, so forth. We need to be putting pressure on our media to be more responsible. And similarly, I think
it's really got to be going after the one on your side, right? I mean, the liberals already boycott Fox News because they don't watch it, right? And so, and I'm sure the conservatives aren't going to Michael Moore films.
Yeah.
So if you see a flaw on your side, coming from your side, you've got to somehow stand up for it. No?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you mean on the personal level, is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think we need to take a deep breath. One of the things we're trying to teach at the university, which is, you know, we are dealing with adults there, is, for example, when you're in a situation where you think that you're going to have or you know that you're going to have a volatile discussion or a discussion that matters to a lot of people on an emotional level, you can start off with a code of conduct. You know,
right.
That's what we're teaching. It's things like that. It's incredibly effective to have any group of people take 5 minutes, 10 minutes at the beginning of a group gathering and say, how are we going to treat each other here? Everybody, let's agree on that together. You know, we are not going to interrupt. We are not going to call names. We are not going to, you know, make slurs. And, you know, we are going to insist if somebody makes a statement that is a statement, an assertion of fact, we may ask you to go into where did you get that information if people question it. You know, we agree on how we're going to.
Kind of a leadership issue in that sense.
Yeah, and a process issue. We can do this in almost every setting. It doesn't take that long to do that. So that's certainly one thing. One of the things we learned and we're teaching at the university has to do with Alaska Native ways of discourse and deliberation, which have to do with the fact that they do not, as each person speaks in traditional Alaska Native ways of deliberation, for starters, each person's voice is assumed to be necessary. And even if you disagree with them completely, that their point of view adds something to the big picture of what's going on here that we need to be addressing, right? And one of the things I've learned from elders is that whenever they make their statement and they are speaking after a person who spoke before them, the first thing they do is they get up and they say, Becky is a wise woman and she needs to be listened to by you. And she's a wonderful worker and a civic contributor. And maybe you're a mother. I don't know your background. And you should take what she says seriously. And then I might say something that is directly contradictory to what she just said. Right. Because those truths are true. Both of them can be true. Like you said, the complexity is there. There are multiple truths in any situation, and sometimes they're directly opposite, and they're both true. Mm-hmm. You know, so but we can learn and teach ourselves to not. It doesn't have to be either or.
Right. Let me go to this caller who's been waiting quite a while. They're actually stacking up a little bit. Beth, did you have a comment?
Yes, I have some good news about civility with our assembly. I testified before the Anchorage Assembly last night, and I found that the tone in the room was very warm and positive and receptive. And I walked away thinking, wow, with a change in leadership and maybe a chairperson who could lead us into more civil discussions. Perhaps he might end up gaveling out people that make personal comments against other assembly members or just members of the public. It was a really good experience, and I'm hoping for a local change in our assembly dialogue.
Oh, I hope you're right, because the assembly has not been a great example for the last couple of years. And Becky Hultberg, who I should reintroduce our guest, it was the press secretary for Governor Frank Murkowski, and Libby Rodrick is here, a well-known musician, has played all over the country and is now working with the UAA APU Difficult Dialogues Project. Becky Hultberg, how does leadership play into this? I mean, it seems like that if our leaders are demanding more of us, maybe we'll perform better. How did you, when you were in Juneau, did you see leaders who were trying to keep their supporters in a civil dialogue, or were they more trying to whip people up to support them, you know, perhaps less civilly?
Well, I think leaders obviously have a very important role to play, and our politicians obviously have a very important role to play. The challenge for leadership is not as much during governing as it is during the campaign. And that's where I think some of our dialogue can really degenerate or be elevated during the campaign season. So I think I want to hear, and what I'm personally looking for is I want to hear those running for office acknowledge the issues and really get beyond the soundbite, and let's talk about what the real issues are, and let's talk about how we can come together and solve them. Our campaigns, because of the nature of our media, which is not a bad thing, it's just the way it is, really end up tending to be about the soundbite answer. And we've got to find a way as a society to get beyond that and to demand more than that. And that's really one of the things that the earlier question was personally, what can we do? And what I think we can do is we can be our own critics for our own, those who believe like we do. We can call out hypocrisy. We can call out inconsistency. And it's more effective if we're doing it among the people that believe similar ways to us, instead of just pointing at the other guys and saying, you're a hypocrite, you don't tell the truth. Well, let's look at ourselves and let's police ourselves. And the second thing is read. We don't, as a society, read enough. And not just the things we agree with, but the things we disagree with. Because I think that's really, it sounds so simple, but it's really a way that you really internalize an argument. You really understand. You really have to engage at that deeper level if you're reading something as opposed to watching.
Right. Well, Beth, in your experience at the Assembly, had you been there earlier and seen a less civil discourse than you were seeing at this outing, or what were you comparing it to?
Well, I have been before the Assembly on many occasions, and I happened to be there one night during the histrionics of the debate about gays in our society, and it was a terrible experience, actually, just the people in the room and the people outside waving signs. And then I've also seen a lot of quotes where people from the public have been allowed to malign the officials sitting there behind the dais. So there have been some very uncomfortable moments at the Anchorage Assembly in these past couple of years, as you said. And I'm really looking for a leader who I certainly would disagree with many things Mr. Trainee might believe in, but I'm so much appreciate the fact that it looks like he's very interested in being civil and polite to all the people that have something to say to the Assembly.
Okay, well, thanks very much for your call. And now I'd like to go to Tina, who has a comment. Tina?
Hi. I was just, the thing that distresses me is the listener or writer comments that are in the paper or online mostly, because letters to the editor get into the paper, but it's a screening process. When people are allowed to just bang away at, and make conjecture and have uncivil discourse following you know, a newspaper article, it just really distresses me, because then that becomes part of the news. People read those comments and take away a lot of misinformation. And I just wonder, you know, why is that part of news? And that was what I wanted to say.
Yeah, well, the good question. That was a big topic of the forum that we had on Friday, and Pat Doherty from the Anchorage Daily News was there, and he agreed that those comments really don't have a lot of positive to add. You know, that they tend to be very much just slamming people, and there's not much reasoning in them, and that part of that may be because they're anonymous. And so then the question comes up, well, why are they anonymous? And he essentially said, technology wise, they don't have any way to guarantee that, you know, if you require people to give their names, that they're giving real names, unless you were to require them to put in a credit card or something like that. It kind of raises a question, and let me turn to Libby Rodrick on this. I think there was a lot of hope about new media and the internet and all the discussion it was going to bring, but I'm not sure. It's certainly a mixed bag, and I'm not sure it's even on balance positive, because so much of the so-called debate or discourse that comes on the internet is really not discourse at all. It's just sort of people kind of yelling at each other, demonizing one another. I've noticed that sort of from the right, it tends to be anger and outrage, and from the left, it tends to be ridicule, and neither one is really adding anything to debate. So what do you think about the sort of the way the internet's being used and how it could be made better?
Yikes.
Big one, huh?
Yeah.
In 30 seconds.
Yeah, exactly. Well, all technology is a mixed bag. I mean, there's an upside and a downside. I think that in terms of the global impact, it's been fabulous. I think that there's nobody on the planet that's on the internet anymore that can demonize a person in any country and think they're not a human being. And I know when I was in high school, we actually thought that Russians – I mean, that was a big issue. I was involved in that particular issue of people really thought they were a different kind of human being. I mean, this is not very long ago. So on that side, the balance is hugely on the positive. On this more sort of micro level, I guess you'd say, I agree, and I'm not totally sure. I think from the standpoint of a news media outlet, I don't know why they have to do that. Why they have to open up every, you know, article to anybody who wants to comment on it. I mean, unless that's some kind of a marketing tool. And I don't know what we're going to be able to do about it. I mean, I really appreciate those groups who, during campaigns, political campaigns, make it their business. And I think NPR did this for a while, saying, okay, we just went through Obama's speech. Here are the pieces that were wrong factually. We just went through what, you know, Sarah Palin said. Here are the pieces that were wrong factually. You know, but you can't do that on the internet. Mm-hmm. There's millions of people doing all these little comments. So I'm actually not sure.
Yeah. Well, it seems like the dream was that you can have letters to the editor about every article, and everybody can have their say, and so you're going to find out what people really think, and so the vox populi. But it hasn't really worked out that way. I mean, I don't know. Have you looked at those comments, Becky? What do you think?
Oh, yeah. I think I understand some of the practical reasons why it's difficult to attribute, make everyone attribute a quote to themselves. I think on the same token, I think that when you're forced to identify yourself, the tone of the dialogue changes dramatically. So I'd argue for at least put the box there and make them put something. If they put Mickey Mouse, delete the comment. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's obvious that's not them. So I really do think that attributing comments to people really does help. And really, the internet is our new public space. And so we need to learn to work within it. Our technology has gone a little faster than our social processes. We need to catch up and figure out how, given this new technological environment, we can make that discourse valuable for our democracy. That's the piece I think we're still struggling with.
Yeah. One interesting thing that came up at this forum that I was on was that, on Facebook, where people do have to have an account and they do have their face shown, tends to be a lot more civil, and it's so that when you've got an investment of your identity in it, it is. We're going to go to a break in just a minute, but first I want to take Eric's call, who's been waiting for a while. Eric?
Hi, yes, this is Eric. I have, when it comes to misinformation and the disclosure of information, the recession that we're going through was a major source of misinformation that was later went from a recession to a economic slowdown, but the damage was done, which later affected OPEC. OPEC raised the price of fuel, which actually ended up in the biggest robbery of this state in this country and affected the entire world economy. But when
nobody, when it comes down to civility, nobody is doing anything about this problem, about the misinformation of the economic slowdown, which is a bad call by the media, basically saying that this happened and now it's not. When it went from recession to economic slowdown, that's just, it just became a major, major economic problem.
Okay,
and
well, thanks for...
It's civility where nobody does anything about it.
Right. Okay, well, thanks for your comment. We're going to have to go to the break, and we're going to be back in just a moment with more of Hometown Alaska.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen again to Hometown Alaska on KSKA, the show repeats tonight at 10. Remember, tonight's recorded rebroadcast will not be taking phone calls. Following this afternoon's broadcast, you can also find a copy of today's Hometown Alaska online at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
We're back on Hometown Alaska. My name is Charles Wolforth, and the show today is about civil discourse, getting along, debating civilly, and working together and so forth. And we're inviting listeners to get involved. So far, everybody's been done a good job of being pretty civil. The phone number here is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. The toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And you can also send an email, hometownalaska@kska.org. And if you go to kska.org, you'll find a number of links, backup information, more to learn about our show and our topic. I have two guests today, Libby Roderick, who is best known as a singer and for her recordings and performances that she's done, and also is with the UAA APU Difficult Dialogues Project, which I want to learn more about in just a minute. And my other guest is Becky Holtberg, former press secretary for Governor Murkowski, who is now does communications with the Providence Medical hospital or medical system. We have a caller that I want to talk to right now, and then I have some more that I want to learn about Libby's program. Christine, did you have something you wanted to contribute?
Yes, good afternoon. I have had taken the opportunity to write a letter in the opinion section in regards to a school bus accident, and I had made a comment. And I was hesitant. I wasn't sure. I did write my name, and I did present my phone number. I had mailed it in the mail. And when I saw it in the paper, the comments that I had received after the letter was in, it was quite shocking. It was almost like I had to think about the arguments and the name calling and the slanders, innuendos to my response in the paper to the accident. But the one that was most disturbing is that when it came out in the paper, I had received a message on my phone, and it was a private call, and that someone had left a message telling me that I didn't know what I was talking about and was going on and slandering and yelling at me. And I was astounded. How could somebody get my phone number? It was only my first name. It was the phone number. Everything was written with the letter. You get 250 words. Somebody called my home and left me a message in regards to my letter. The only thing I could think about was, is it somebody from the newspaper?
Yeah.
I haven't written to the newspaper and opinion section since then.
Yeah, I understand your feelings. I had a young friend who was a daughter of a family friend who was written up in an article in essentially a positive way. This was actually not in Anchorage. It was in another town. And those comments that were online were just tearing her apart. And, you know, she cried over it, and you could certainly see why. And it's not the only time I've heard of it. Also, when articles about Alaska Natives in their paper, they're consistently, you know, very inappropriate racist comments. And so people, I don't know who these people are, but they're obviously people who are out there who have a problem and are using that to sort of vent. And then the people who are on the receiving end, especially if they're innocent children, kind of don't know what hit them. So let me take that. Thanks for your call, Christine. Let me take that on to another topic with Libby Roderick. What do you think has gotten into people? I mean, it's not all of media. I mean, what's you know?
Right. Well, I don't know, of course, as usual. But I do think a lot about the issue of powerlessness. And this is kind of an odd segue here, possibly. But the U.S. is one a nation in which we don't really talk about the issue of class. We talk about race, we talk about gender, we talk about sexual identity, we talk about a lot of things, but we don't really talk about class. And sometimes I wonder, and I have nothing to back this up, whether or not a lot of this has to do with all sorts of pockets of really deep senses of powerlessness in certain groups of people, certain kinds of individuals, because really we're talking about violence here. And you know, emotional violence, social violence, relational violence, if not sometimes physical violence. And I was thinking about, there's also this marvelous process called nonviolent communication that I was mentioning to you both earlier, which is kind of a rigorous process of helping people identify the needs they have underneath some of their combative behavior, because you can actually help somebody address a need, whereas you can't always feel their combative behavior. But it grew out of Gandhi's work, where he sent his grandson out at one point to document every day what sorts of violence he saw in his society, and to mark on his wall in his little hut whether it was emotional violence or physical violence. And he filled that wall every day with incidences of emotional violence. And then there'd only be a few physical violence effects. And his grandfather said the emotional violence incidences is what results in those incidences of physical violence. And you see where most of our problem is. And I just wonder oftentimes, and it's not the only source for certain, but there is a lot of senses of isolation in our society. There's a lot of sense of powerlessness. And in particular, with respect to class, things have gotten much worse for people.
Economically. Not
just, yes, not just the recession. You know, it was already starting to happen. There's been this slow burn down for many, many people. And their lives have gotten a lot harder. And I think when you're in a community, you know you belong, you know you're cared about, and you know you answer to a community, that you are more civil. You know you have a shared future, and you know you matter. And I think many, many people don't have that sense now, that they matter, that they're cared about, and that they answer to anybody, and that they share a future with anybody, because things have gotten really tough. So that's a thought.
Yeah, let me turn to Becky Holtberg. I mean, do you think that there's something about people that's happened, as Libby is saying, or is it more a media issue, or how do you come down on that?
I think that that's obviously a really complex question, and I don't know that we're going to, you know, that we could really even get to the root of it in an hour. But I think when I look at sort of this issue of maybe not why people behave the way they do, but why they can't seem to engage in the world of ideas, and they have to engage in the world of personal attacks, I think there are obviously some of the factors that Libby just talked about, you know, socioeconomic factors or whatever is going on with them personally and the way they interact with people. But I think if you look at the broader culture, we've really become, with our reality TV shows and with our politicians, a world where we glorify the personality, not necessarily because there is any innate virtue or accomplishment, but just because it's a personality. And so with that, I think we've really kind of distorted the kind of people that we view as heroes and the way we view their behavior. And I think that is to the detriment of our overall society, when you don't necessarily have to be accomplished to be a superstar. You don't necessarily have to have great ideas and really compelling, compelling vision to engage in the world of politics. And so I think really we've almost developed a cult of personality that prevents us from engaging in that really thoughtful dialogue.
And some of the what I see on TV, and I don't see that much TV, but I'm which maybe causes me to be more shocked when I see it because I'm not acclimatized to it. But so there seem to be a lot of shows where people are ridiculed or held up as objects and really not as human beings. And when I see that, I think, well, that's teaching a lesson for next time you encounter somebody you disagree with, not to see them as a person.
And we're teaching them that when you disagree with someone, you attack the personality, because that's the most important thing. Mm-hmm. Rather than when you disagree with someone and discuss your differences of opinion or your differences in philosophy. And so we really end up in a situation where we cannot – certain people have never had a dialogue about ideas. They've only had attacks between people.
Yeah. Well, we've got a couple of calls waiting, but I really wanted to have Libby Roderick tell us about the Difficult Dialogues Project and what it exactly is you're trying to accomplish and how you're going about it.
Okay. Yeah, I appreciated what you just said also, because there's a great statement that came as part of that project in which we're not trying to make ideas safe for our students on campus. We're trying to make students safe for ideas. Mm-hmm. the Difficult Dialogues Project originated from the Ford Foundation. Several years back, they issued an RFP to all accredited universities nationwide because they have documented a trend in hostilities and polarization and intolerance particularly in terms of ethnicity and religion. And there's been some very disturbing things happening on different campuses. And so UAA and APU applied as a partnership and got this grant. Each of the grants were very different at different universities nationwide. We were proud of it. There were only 26 that got the grant the first time and 13 that got it the second. And the intention is really to make our climates safer for civil or more welcoming of civil discourse, more welcoming of diverse opinions, and to train. In our case, we focus largely on faculty in both campuses through using week-long intensives to give them a range of skills for how to proactively introduce controversial topics in their classrooms and have it go well. And, you know, on a minor level, we've also trained them if you deal with a disruptive student and, you know, student harassment, those kinds of issues. But primarily, we're looking at how do you successfully introduce a topic that you might otherwise duck, because they were documenting that nationwide. Again, many faculty members just didn't want to take on certain issues anymore because of the kinds of incivilities in the classroom. And we also are very concerned about students who already come into the campuses for whatever reasons – less likely to feel that their voice can be heard anyway. I'm thinking now of Alaska Native students, students from different cultural backgrounds where you don't assert yourself, you don't fight, you don't yell at other people. You know, mm-hmm. They might get even more silent than they might already be. So our two grants have addressed, like I said, primarily training faculty in this wide range of skills for doing that.
So, and you mentioned like giving the ground rules at the beginning.
Developing code of conducts with your students is a fabulous, very quick way of ensuring civility throughout the semester. Mm-hmm. We've trained them in everything from Western styles of debate, where they have their students. And one of the great things about that is that the students are trained in all different sides of a debate and then are told when they get close to the debate, which side they're going to argue. So they've actually had to train themselves to see the viewpoints of multiple different parties, not just their own. Mm-hmm. Lovely thing to do. We have a wonderful thing called the 5-minute rule, where for 5 minutes you entertain a view that you would otherwise dismiss or marginalize, and you can only speak to it in a positive light. And then the class can go back and debrief about how that works. And there's a multitude of these things, Alaska Native ways of dealing with conflict and so forth. We've also had the Books of the Year program, which you've probably heard about, which is a way of going through a shared text on both of our campuses and multiple disciplines to tackle a controversial thing. And we developed a handbook called Start Talking, which is available online. It's on your link for this program, I know, that shows all of these approaches and has essays from the faculty. Yeah. And then lastly, we looked at difficult dialogues between our Alaska Native communities and our higher ed institutions here, and have been acquainting faculty more with those issues.
Great. I want to read you an email, which is from Ann Brooks, who works in gathering public comment from the public on engineering projects around town. We had her as a guest on a previous show. She says, in our political process, it seems the conversation stops because of the partisan nature of the discussion. It seems like the conversation is a non-starter because the positions are already set. We've lost the ability to listen and really hear the problems or solutions that the public can provide. I'm increasingly frustrated because I don't believe sustainable decisions are being made in the interest of Alaskans for the long haul. She goes to say, as a follow-up, when the discourse is not civil, people check out, don't participate at all because they avoid conflict or don't want to subject themselves to it. So there's a break. I mean, there's what Ann's pointing out is there's a real cost to this, which is you get a breakdown, the situation gets worse, people feel alienated from government, from their neighbors, and they sort of go into their own bunkers.
Well, you go into your ideological corner.
Right.
And that's what we see is people retreat to their ideological corner. And as a result, whoever wins gets to shape a decision, or you don't have a decision at all. And I think the decisions that we make from a public policy standpoint are worse, are more less informed or more poor because we don't engage in that the richness of that conversation, out of which could come a solution that's better than anything we've thought of before.
Mm-hmm. Can I kick in something? Yeah. I'm very proud of this. We have sponsored since 2003 through the Faculty Development Center at UAA a series of public policy debates, faculty forums, and public discussions. And the way they work, they happen twice a year. We have a public policy issue, whether it's cap and trade for climate change or whether it's immigration issues or the Patriot Act or what have you. And the UAA award-winning speech and debate team takes the first 40 minutes to debate the issue back and forth, the way that they do. We then follow that with faculty from four different disciplines weighing in and framing the debate from their disciplinary standpoint. And we then have a public discussion. And why it works so well is that the public, when they come in, the charge for the debate team is to quickly lay out all the different positions that are out there in the public sphere, right? And they do that rather well. And so the people listening hear their viewpoint, usually represented, so they can calm down.
Right.
You know, they've been heard on a certain sense and fought for, you know?
Yeah. And
then the faculty get to complexify it, you know, as you'd say, you know, make it more complicated, add things, correct things, and show their disciplinary perspective on that issue. And then when we have the discussion, it's actually informed. People actually feel heard. And it's a very civil exchange between a now reasonably well-informed public on a public policy issue. And they're quite beautiful, these mm-hmm. events.
Yeah. Let me go to a caller who's been waiting, and we're going to get to you, caller, so hang on. Laura, did you have a comment?
Yes. I would just like to say that I've engaged in a lot of difficult dialogue with people. I'm pretty liberal, pretty radical in many of my views, but I still enjoy sitting down with people from the other side and really trying to hear. And I found the hardest thing is when your humanity is rejected by the person that you're talking to, or when you reject the other person's humanity, there's really no way to move forward. And I found myself doing that, and I have been deeply, deeply hurt when people have done that to me. And I think that that really is the center of all of this. And I think that the guests on the show have really sort of highlighted that as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, what are the settings where you can do that successfully, where you can have that kind of conversation with somebody who feels very strongly? I mean, you might say, well, it's a personal setting, but how many people have been at a bad Thanksgiving dinner where, you know, these kinds of, you'd think if anybody's humanity is going to be respected, it's somebody in your own family. But sometimes those discussions can be really negative. Laura, where have you found that it works? What are the settings where it works?
I think the setting is definitely kind of what Libby has been hinting at, is where you have to walk into it with the understanding on both sides that you're going to recognize each other's humanity. And if you don't do that, there's a high defensiveness. I've had a lot of religious conversations with people in my own religion, which is Quakerism, or with people in other religions, and just really sort of engaging in that without that understanding that we both have families that we go home to and that we take care of, that we both have deep concerns for our communities. And if we don't recognize that, it is really easy to just, like I think Becky said earlier about the personalities, that it's just, you are a personality, you're not a human entity that I have to recognize in that way.
Good point. Becky, did you want to add to that?
I think, you know, this actually led into something that I really did want to talk about, which is we've talked a little bit about partisanship, and that is one element of this. We are not just talking about polarization on party lines. This is a much broader issue. It can be a dispute in your neighborhood. It can be, as you said, as you talked about, Charles, something at the PTA. It does not this is not necessarily a quote unquote partisan issue. I think that is definitely one factor in the incivility in our country, but it is a much broader social issue than a partisan issue.
Yeah, there's sort of a feeling of over caffeination at times, and sometimes I wonder if it's just the pace of life has gotten a little too fast, and everybody's really not slowing down to recognize that.
It can be disputes within a party that can be just as vicious as disputes between parties. Mm-hmm. Or, like I said, it can be over a neighborhood, a family, a community issue.
All right. Now, Stefan, I want to thank you for waiting. Do you have a comment? Oh, we lost him. He had to wait too long. Don't blame him. I kept him on hold for a long time. So in talking about sort of this local, personal aspect of it, and getting all the way down to dealing with your neighbor. And there's an article in the newspaper not too long about a guy who looks out his window and sees a small dog coming on his property and so shoots it with a shotgun. And this kind of sort of thing that leads to the extreme. Do you have a sense, Libby, about how we deal with that other than just trying to be nice? I mean, what's the because we don't always have referees to tell us how to deal with these things.
No. Well, I'm thinking about a person who's been a teacher in my life, a woman named Joanna Macy, who's quite a remarkable teacher and activist. And she has emphasized how you can listen people into change. You cannot argue them into change. And so for me personally, when I am dealing with a hostile neighbor or something, if I can marshal my own resources and not, you know, I think we're all tired and we're overworked and stressed. And I do think that that's a piece of it. And it puts everybody a little more edgy. But I try to drop out of the experience and just give the person attention. There are any number of projects. There was a listening project that happened in the South any number of years ago called the Listening Project. And there was a lot of racial tension in this particular community. And they trained a bunch of listeners to go door to door and just listen to people. And they'd come in and they'd ask some things. And you know, it'd be, a white family. And the person would start out saying, blaming their economic situation on their neighbors who were of color, and making slurs about them and all sorts of things like that, and that was why things were going the way they were and so forth and so on. And the person was trained simply to listen. Say, tell me more about that. Where did you get that position? Where did that idea come from? I'd like to hear more, right? Which is a very disciplined, rigorous thing to be able to do when someone is doing what they were listening to. But what they found over and over again is that as the person was listened to, as they got to vent their frustration and their sense of powerlessness and their anger and their wish to blame somebody somewhere for their situation, suddenly they go, well, actually, you know, what I think is really going on is the plant closed and this and that happened. And actually, so-and-so is a really good guy and he's a good parent for his kids. And actually, you know, so just on the most personal level. But I did want to say that process is something we're missing in a lot of our situations. We go into, like I said, charged situations without process intact that will ensure. I have moderated. I was asked years ago to moderate between pro-life and pro-choice people. And there's a long story behind why I was chosen. It was basically because I was civil to the party that was on the disagreeing end for me. And they were so blown away by that I was chosen years later to be the facilitator between these two groups, because I was the only person they'd met that had been civil to them, if that makes sense. Anyways, and what was key to bringing together these two groups that so disagree was we spent a lot of time on what was common ground between us, the different groups. And I set up a very rigorous process for how we were going to interact. And it worked. Everybody managed to be civil. They knew they'd be taken care of. They knew they'd be protected. They knew they would not be attacked, et cetera, right? They knew they would be heard. And I think we need to take that much more seriously. And there are a lot of, for those of you who are interested, there are a lot of processes out there in the world. There's the Conversation Cafe. There's something called the World Cafe. There's a democracy process. There's, you know, our Quakers. Somebody called in as a Quaker, had a wonderful exchange on subsistence issues where they went through a very rigorous listening project to both process to both sides. There's a whole bunch of things. Common Ground does some of this here. But I think we need to think a lot more when we go into many different kinds of situations about what are the rules of the game here and how are we going to interact? And if the other parties aren't going to go along with them, what are we going to do?
Yeah. Becky, I'm interested in what you think about the future. We're obviously in a time of drastic change. And in fact, if you look back in history, you can find other periods in our history when we've had some pretty bad times of incivility. You know, you think about the 1960s when there was a Vietnam War going on and people, you know, it wasn't just disagreement. There were people being killed on campuses. I even went back and read when I was working on a project, old newspapers from before unification of the city and borough in Anchorage, in which Libby's father, Jack Roderick, was involved as the borough mayor. And I don't think I ever heard Jack say anything uncivil in those materials, but man, people could really, really get angry. And you had the city suing the borough, and you had just horrible things being said. Seems like now we're in another time of change. How do we get out of this into, you know, the internet's not going away and the recession is seems to be with us for a while, and a lot of these things seem to be with us. Do you have a sense for what the future holds in terms of this?
Well, I think that if I had the answer to that question, I could probably write a book and make a lot of money, yeah. And I don't necessarily have the answer to it. But I think, you know, as a society, we've always pulled together during difficult times. And sometimes it's been the external things that have galvanized us toward more civil discourse. I think that on one hand, the recession has made people, has has made people feel insecure and unstable, which I think has led to some uncivil behavior. But I also think it's encouraged people to do things like, rather than going out and spending money on entertainment, having their neighbors over for dinner. And I think that's a positive outcome of the difficult economic climate that we're in. So I, from a macro standpoint, our social structures and our value system need to catch up with our technology. I don't know exactly what that looks like. But I do think that as a society, we have to decide what we value. Do we value things as simply as kindness? Do we value personality and entertainment? What as a society do we value, and how, and because really it's what our values are that will result in how we treat each other.
Mm-hmm. Well, where do you see that in your life? Where do you see those positive discussions taking place? What are the same question I asked of the caller? What are the settings where the sort of the things that are fulfilling and engaging? Where are those happening for you?
Well, I think right now that my best I have a young family, so the best conversations we have are at the dinner table. And it's my hope that through the dinner table conversations that we have, we can encourage our kids to have that, to develop critical thinking skills and not to take everything that they hear at face value. I've had some very interesting conversations where my daughter, who's 11, has come home and said, "Well, this is what I read in a book." I said, "Well, just because you read something in a book, does that mean that it's true?" And you kind of see a little light bulb like, you mean things I read might not be true, or things I read on the internet might not be true. So mm-hmm. In my life, that's where I am right now. So the opportunity I have is not as much for civil discourse as it is for family discourse.
Yeah.
That's
kids. Where it all begins. Yeah. Yeah. Well, thanks. Thanks for that. And Libby, same question for you. Where outside of these, obviously, things where you're setting it up, where do you find the most fulfilling discourse and conversations that you're having?
Well, I happen to just have a history myself of being interested in going after people who are different than I am. So I find myself in those situations a lot where, going outside of my comfort zone to go into a community or a setting or go to an event that isn't of my group, so to mm-hmm. speak, on purpose. So I find myself in that situation a lot. There are also groups I'm part of, Healing Racism in Anchorage is a great group where people get together and get out of their comfort zones to reach across some of the divides between people that way. Like I mentioned, I happen to be friends with the person who started this process called Conversation Cafe, which is taking over Seattle, where people just go to bookstores or whatever. There's a very simple process that they can throw open and invite to anybody who comes and entertain big ideas with people with very, very divergent viewpoints mm-hmm. and have a wonderful time treating each other quite well. But most of them, I think, in my personal life are personal conversations. Yeah. I happen to be with people who are pretty open-minded on this front, so I'm lucky in that regard.
Maybe that's where we get it all started. Well, we've used up an hour, and it's been really interesting. I want to thank my guests, Libby Roderick and Becky Holtberg. Libby is a musician, and where do they find your records? But give your website.
LibbyRoderick.com.
There you go. And Becky is with Providence Hospital, and she's also a former gubernatorial press secretary. Next week, Kathleen McCoy will be hosting another edition of Hometown Alaska. Pat Yak is the Vice President of News and Public Media here at APTI. Kristen Spack, again, fantastic job engineering the program with the assistance from Constance Huff. My name is Charles Wolforth. Thanks for listening.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated News and Public Media. An archived copy of today's program, additional information, and links to all the websites mentioned on today's show are available online at kska.org. Send us your comments and suggestions of things you'd like to talk about at Hometown Alaska, 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. This is KSKA Anchorage.